I've talked about the power of visualization. In this lecture, I want to put visualization to work in examining some of the fundamental elements of all reasoning. You certainly know about atoms, and you can envisage them binding into molecules. The atoms of reasoning are concepts, the topic of this lecture. By the end, we'll be talking about how those atom concepts bind together into the molecules of reasoning, propositions. Concepts are the most basic elements in all thinking. Concepts are what we think with. In The Philosophical Investigations, the 20th century philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein says, "The aspects of things that are most important for us are hidden because of their simplicity and familiarity. One is unable to notice something because it's always before one's eyes." Something like that applies here. In this lecture, I want to emphasize some familiar facts and simple visualization techniques regarding the basic elements of thought. Simple, but fundamental. We'll rely on these facts and reach for these techniques repeatedly in further lectures. Let's begin with concepts. Everyone knows that concepts are ideas and that words represent those ideas. But people tend to think that concepts just float around in a random sea. They think of the universe of concepts as something like this: justice, presidential power, integrity, democracy, self-determination, convenience, economics, mercy, beauty, efficiency. Justice is a concept. Presidential power is a concept. Self-determination is a concept. Each of these is a word. Each word represents a concept, and the concepts are just concepts, all about the same. You can think of concepts as either things in your brain, your concepts, or as something we share as part of our culture, our concepts. But it's still true that many people think of them as just flotsam and jetsam, floating randomly in a mental or cultural sea. The fundamental fact I want to emphasize is that concepts do not float around independently. Physical atoms are organized by physical structure, the physical structure represented in the periodic table. As the atoms of thought, concepts come with their own inherent organizational structure, too. Crucial to all effective thinking is an ability to visualize that inherent conceptual structure and to put it to use. What you actually heard a few minutes ago were words: justice, presidential power, self-determination. The words themselves are just combinations of sounds, or if written, certain combinations of marks. The concepts lie behind those words, not the words we use, but the ideas we express with those words. Is there a difference between words and concepts? Absolutely. The words are different from language to language. The concepts are not. It's frog in English, but frosch in German, and sapo in Portuguese, and grenouille in French. Different words, but just one concept. The recognition that concepts are distinct from words has been part of the philosophical toolkit at least since Aristotle in 350 BC. The Greeks supposedly called other people barbarians, including Egyptians, Etruscans, and Persians, because they sounded like they were babbling, bar, bar, bar. That makes the beginning passages of Aristotle's On Interpretation particularly remarkable. What Aristotle says is that words are symbols or signs for affections or impressions of the soul. Speech is not the same for all races of men, but the mental affections themselves, of which these words are the signs, Aristotle says, are the same for all mankind. We use words to express concepts, but words are different from the concepts they express. Simple as it is, that point turns out to be crucial in building good reasoning, in detecting bad reasoning, and in reasoning effectively together. Here's why. Because concepts and words are different, a single concept may be expressed by many different words. Even more importantly, Very different concepts may lie behind the same word. Consider the word bank, for example, and listen to the following story. The plane's engine suddenly cut out. The pilot put his plane into a bank in order not to crash into the town below. He guided his plane safely to the riverbank so as not to hit the bank on Main Street. The word bank appeared 3 times in that story. You had no trouble in grasping the different concept between the same word, behind the same word each time. This is a harmless example, but there are a range of debates in which different concepts may lie behind a different word. Consider the word fairness. In a particular case, we may have to ask whether fair is being used to mean to all alike, or according to prior agreement, or to each according to his need, or to each according to his investment, to each according to his effort, or to each according to some standard of merit. Because different concepts may lie behind the same word, we may be talking past each other unless we identify the particular concept we have in mind by a particular word. Equality and liberty and terrorism are important words, but only because of the ideas behind them. Those are important ideas. All the more reason to be sure we can identify the specific concept at issue. Concepts don't just float around in a random sea. They come with their own relationships and inherent structure between them. Here are some questions. A simple example. Are frogs a kind of vertebrate, or are vertebrates a kind of frog? Are mammals a kind of squirrel, or are squirrels a kind of mammal? Easy. Frogs are a kind of vertebrate. It's not that vertebrates are a kind of frog. Mammals aren't a kind of squirrels. Squirrels are a kind of mammal. Those concepts have a kind of logical order, a relational structure. Words apply to concepts. Concepts apply to what? If we use the word things in full generality, recognizing not only physical things, but things like ideas, what concepts apply to are things. The concept of idea applies to ideas. The concept of frog applies to frogs. What we're talking about then is really a three-part relationship. The relationship between words, concepts, and the things those concepts apply to. Words express concepts. Concepts apply to things. We might say that words apply to things too, secondhand. Words express the concepts that apply to things. Philosophers speak of the totality of things that a concept applies to as its extension. What's the extension of a concept? Just all the things that word applies to. We can express precisely the same thing in terms of set theory. What are all the things that the concept frogs applies to? The set of all frogs. Here's where a visualization comes in. Try to imagine all the frogs, past, present, and future, gathered into one corral. What that corral contains is the extension of the concept frog, the set of all frogs. In the same way, the extension of the concept of vertebrates is a corral with all vertebrates in it. The extension of the concept of idea, well, that's an interesting one. It's the set of all ideas, past, present, and future. Can you form a real physical corral of any of these things? No. But you can form a conceptual corral. You can gather them in thought. Venn diagrams are a way of visualizing the relations between concepts in terms of their extensions. So think of a corral for frogs, a corral with all the things the concept applies to. Now, without disturbing that first corral, think of another corral for vertebrates, inside of which are all the vertebrates, not only frogs, but sharks and squirrels and you. The only way to conceptualize that, to build a corral for vertebrates without disturbing the one you've already built for frogs, is to have one corral inside the other. Your original frog corral will be inside the larger vertebrates corral. One circle inside another. Are all squirrels are mammals? There will be a squirrel circle inside a larger mammal circle. All amphibians are animals? One circle inside another. We can think of what we're talking about as sets and subsets. The set of frogs is a subset of the set of vertebrates. Or is the extension of one concept including the extension of another? or is the scope of one concept, including the scope of another? Those all come down to the same relationship, and that relationship is captured by internal circles in a Venn diagram. Aristotle approached the relations of concepts in terms of categories and subcategories, genus and species. Today we think of genus and species as terms in biology, but in Aristotle the idea is much more general. Some categories include smaller and more specific categories within them. A larger inclusive category is the genus. The smaller categories inside, specified by further differentia, are the species. That idea, too, amounts to circles inside circles, just like the circles in Venn diagrams. The diagrams are named after John Venn, a 19th century logician. There was another logician about the same time who came up with a similar idea, though he used squares. That other logician was Charles Dodgson. Charles Dodgson may not be a familiar name to you, but you already know quite a bit about him. In addition to his work as a mathematical logician, Dodgson wrote peculiar fantasy stories for a little girl named Alice. He used the pseudonym Lewis Carroll. There's a philosophical distinction that's important at this point, a distinction between the connotation and the denotation of a concept. That distinction has its roots in the medieval scholastics, but it appears with particular prominence in the work of John Stuart Mill. Denotation concerns the things that a concept applies to, its extension, just the things themselves. That's different from the connotation of words or concepts. The fact that concepts often label things with a particular flavor or emotional association. So here's a concept for you. Your grandmother's cookies. The denotation of that concept is its extension, the cookies themselves, whether you liked them or not. But phrases like grandmother's cookies, let alone grandmother's fresh-baked cookies, let alone grandmother's delicious fresh-baked cookies, clearly come loaded with a positive spin. That emotional take, whether positive or negative, is the connotation. Denotation is crucial to solid rational argument, reasoning in terms of facts about the things themselves. Connotation is the stuff of emotional persuasion, which we know can be far from rational. For that reason alone, it's important to be able to separate the two. So far, we've been talking about the organization of concepts and categories two at a time. But the relationships we're after form much larger structures as well. A second form of visualization takes us farther, visualization in terms of concept trees. There's an analogy between concept trees and family trees. If you drew a family tree for the descendants of Davy Crockett, you might have Davy as the trunk, his children as the first level of branches, their children as branches off of those, all the way down to the twigs, the living descendants of Davy Crockett. There are hundreds of twigs. A concept tree looks exactly like that, except the trunk will be the most general of a set of categories. The first branch will be a first division of subcategories. The next set of branches will be a subdivision of those, all the way down to the twigs. If you're in a situation right now in which you can work with a pencil in hand, that's the best. If you're in a situation in which you can't do that, you have to do it in your mind. If you can imagine drawing the concept tree, you'll be doing exactly what I'm after. Try drawing a concept tree for this set of concepts. Amphibians, vertebrates, squirrels, frogs, tree frogs, mammals, reptiles, turtles, snakes. Which of these concepts is the trunk of the tree? That means, which is the most general? Which is everything else a kind of? That's right, the trunk's going to be vertebrates, animals with backbones. All the rest are kinds of vertebrates. What's the next most general level? At that point, it'll branch into three: mammals, reptiles, and amphibians. Each is a type of vertebrate, none is a type of the other. Then on to the next level. You can test any concept tree for accuracy by starting at any twig and going back to the trunk. It should work like this. Tree frogs are a kind of frog, which is a kind of amphibian, which is a kind of vertebrate. If that works for every branch, you've captured the structure of that set of concepts as a tree diagram. Any set of related concepts can be visualized that way. Here's another one to work out on your own. What's the relationship between these concepts? Western religions, Christianity, Buddhism, religions, Eastern religions, Judaism, Protestantism, Presbyterianism, Confucianism, Zen Buddhism, Orthodox Judaism. Can you see that concept tree form as I say the words? If so, you're exercising precisely the kind of conceptual visualization I'm after. Western religions, Christianity, Buddhism, religions, Eastern religions, Judaism, Protestantism, Presbyterianism, Confucianism, Zen Buddhism, Orthodox Judaism. Our concepts aren't just flotsam in a mental or cultural sea. They come with inherent relationships that can be visualized in terms of Venn diagrams and concept trees. Concepts or categories are just the atoms of thought. Rationality really operates on the next level up, the molecules of thought. Those are called propositions. Let's start again with words. Words express concepts, but you can put words together to make sentences. And what sentences express are, there's no ordinary word for what it is that sentences express. We'll use a not-so-ordinary word instead. The philosopher's word is propositions. The basic idea is easy to get, but it can be hard to explain. A proposition is a claim or a statement or an assertion. It's what you say when you say something. Not the sentence you utter, not the sound you make, but the message you're trying to get across. Propositions are the information packets that we use sentences to express. Remember, concepts aren't just words, they're something behind the words, what the words are used to convey. Propositions aren't just sentences, they're something behind the sentences. There's something extra-linguistic that we use language to convey. Words and concepts don't map onto each other one-to-one. That was the lesson of the story about banks. Sentences and propositions don't map onto each other one-to-one either. Here's a sentence you might hear on the news. I want you to think beyond the sentence to the proposition being expressed. The CIA has succeeded in killing the leader of a major terrorist organization. Here's a different sentence. Different words, different order, different sentence. The head of one of the major terrorist organizations has been killed by the CIA. Do those two sentences express different propositions? Not unless you're extremely nitpicky. One sentence is in the active voice, one sentence is in the passive, one uses a leader instead of head of, a major terrorist organization instead of one of the major, but the message is the same. It's the same packet of information, the same proposition conveyed by two different sentences. How about these two? The deed was done in the billiard room with the rope by Colonel Mustard. Second sentence, Colonel Mustard did it in the billiard room with the rope. In the game Clue, those two sentences give precisely the same information. If you'd win with one, you'd win with the other. So different sentences can express the same proposition. It's also true that the same sentence can express different propositions. Suppose, for example, that we have a tape recording of you yesterday. When we play it back, we hear this sentence. I have a horrible headache. We also have a tape recording of your best friend 3 weeks ago. When we play it back, we hear this sentence. I have a horrible headache. Those are precisely the same sentence, word for word. But it's obvious that they're saying different things. One of them is about you. One of them is about your friend. One of them is about you yesterday. One's about your friend 3 weeks ago. Different people, different times, different headaches. The same sentence used to express different propositions in different contexts. Seeing through sentences to the propositions behind them is hard for some people. What we want to know is whether a sentence asserts something. So consider this one. The Surgeon General says that smoking's bad for your health. Does that sentence assert that smoking is bad for your health? It may say other things too. We want to know whether Part of what it asserts is that smoking is bad for your health. No, that sentence just reports what the Surgeon General says. The phrase, smoking is bad for your health, appears there, but the sentence doesn't say that smoking is bad for your health. That's not part of what the sentence itself asserts. It just says that's what the Surgeon General says. You can't tell whether a sentence asserts that smoking is bad for your health by just trawling for that set of words. You have to understand what the sentence really says in order to know what proposition is being expressed. So listen to the following sentences and tell me which of these assert that smoking causes cancer. Number one, if smoking causes cancer, it's bad for your health. Number two, since smoking causes cancer, it's bad for your health. Number three, although smoking causes cancer, many people continue to smoke. If you said two and three, you're right. With since and although, two and three both commit themselves to the claim that smoking causes cancer. One says smoking's bad for your health if it causes cancer, but it doesn't commit itself to that if. That's not part of what it asserts. How about these? Either smoking causes cancer or car exhaust causes cancer. And this one? Smoking and car exhaust both cause cancer. The first one's an either-or. It doesn't commit to one side in particular. The other commits to both sides. Among other things, then, it does assert that smoking causes cancer. Here's why this is important. In everything we do, it's going to be what's behind the words that matters, not the words themselves. It's the ideas that'll matter, not the words we use for those ideas. It'll be the informational content of sentences that matter, not the sentences themselves. So when we talk about a solid argument, or a rational hypothesis, or a valid line of thought, it's going to be the propositions involved that are the focus of attention. Concepts are the atoms of all logic. Propositions are the molecules. How do the atoms go together to make those molecules? How do concepts go together to make propositions? Let me count the ways. I give up. Too many. But we can start with some simple cases. These are the simple cases that Aristotle started with when he invented logic. They're called categorical propositions because they combine two categories. Consider propositions that look like these. No frogs are philosophers. All neurologists are MDs. Some laws are unjust. Some inventions are not patentable. The first thing to notice is that all four of those propositions link just two categories. We know that categories can be visualized as the circles of Venn diagrams. That visualization technique scales up to diagrams not merely of concepts, but of their combination. All four of these propositions can be represented with overlapping circles for the two categories involved. Draw two overlapping circles. For the first proposition, mark the left circle frogs and the right one philosophers. That'll give you three internal spaces, an area of overlap, the frogs outside that overlap, and the philosophers outside that overlap. Logicians speak of logical space. This is a diagram in logical space. What that first proposition is telling us is that no frogs are philosophers. That means that one of these spaces is empty. Which one? No frogs are philosophers. A philosopher frog would be in that middle overlap area, a member of both circles. The proposition is telling us that there aren't any frog philosophers. It's telling us that that central area is empty. Black out the overlap, and you have a visualization of how those two concepts go together in that proposition. Take the second proposition. All neurologists are MDs. Here again, we start with overlapping circles, labeled neurologists and MDs. Here, in this case, the proposition is that all neurologists are MDs. Here again, it's telling us that one of those three spaces is empty. Which one? That's right. It's telling us that the leftmost space is empty. So scratch it out. All neurologists are MDs. There are no neurologists outside the MD corral. The other two propositions are different. They're giving us positive information rather than negative. They're telling us that something is in a space. So draw overlapping circles for laws and unjust. The third proposition is that some laws are unjust. That means there's something in the overlap. So put an X there. That just means that there is something in that middle area. There's some unjust law. Finally, some inventions are not patentable. You figure that one out. With Venn diagrams, we can go from conceptual atoms to categorical propositions. Those will come in handy a few lectures down the line. Aristotle was the real inventor of logic, a logic that dominated Western philosophy for 2,000 years. It turns out that we can outline all the logic of Aristotle using the visualization you have at your fingertips. Throughout this lecture, we've been talking about categories. Thinking probably couldn't occur at all without that basic logical tool. These days, most tools come with warnings, and that applies to logical tools too. So here are some warnings regarding categories. It's the real things that we group in our categories. But our categories are of our own making. We group things together in terms of what we take to be important similarities. But we could be dead wrong about what's really important. There's no guarantee that our current concepts cut nature at its joints, in the wonderful phrase of the philosopher David Lewis. Consider the Linnaeus system of biological taxonomy, first set down by Carl Linnaeus in his Systema Naturae of 1735. That system divides all living things into phylums and classes, from there into orders, families, genus, and species. It's built on eyeball judgments of anatomical similarity. If what we're interested in is the pattern of evolution, anatomical similarity may not always be a very good indicator. Today, we can use DNA to track the point at which two species shared a common ancestor. In those terms, some species are more closely related than Linnaeus thought. Some species aren't so closely related. It turns out that the Linnaean categories didn't always cut nature at its joints. I started with a random handful of words. Here's another random handful. I want you to take a minute and sort these into three groups. The words are breaded, interior, facades, instinct, brains, fondue. Press pause, sort those into three groups, and come back. So how did you categorize those words? Maybe like this, the B words, breaded, brains, the F words, facades, fondue, the I words, instinct, interior. But then again, maybe you sorted them like this, the food words, breaded, fondue, the architectural words, facades, interior, the mind words, brain, instinct. You might have sorted them like this, the six-letter words, brains, fondue, the seven-letter words, breaded, facades, the eight-letter words, interior, instinct. Which is the right way? There is no right way. Or better, there are lots of right ways. Which is the right way depends on the purpose of the categorization. If you're compiling a dictionary, you want the first way, the B words, the F words. If you're compiling a thesaurus, you want the second way, the food words, the brain words. If you're worried about message length, you want something more like the third. Here's another warning. Categorization can fail for ethical reasons. We're all familiar with the ethnic and racial stereotypes that go hand in hand with discrimination and injustice. Those stereotypes generally come with a heavily negative connotation, with broad negative emotional implications. But there are also times when categorization itself may be unethical. Sometimes it's just plain wrong to think of people in terms of the groups they belong to rather than as individuals in their own right. Categorization is an essential tool of thought, but like other tools, we have to be careful how we use it. What I want you to take away from this lecture are two fundamental ideas. We'll be using those ideas throughout the lectures that follow. First, the idea of concepts behind our words, the atoms of thought. Those concepts bring with them their own inherent structural relationships. A simple way of visualizing those relationships is Venn diagrams. Subcategories within larger categories, subsets within larger sets. An expanded visualization is in terms of concept trees, hierarchical organizations of categories and subcategories, sets and subsets. Second, the idea of propositions behind our sentences, These are the molecules of thought, the stuff of evidence and deliberation, the working material of all rational argument. Categorical propositions can also be visualized in Venn diagrams. We'll use that visualization later as an easy in to all the logic of Aristotle. Before that, however, we'll explore the power of thought experiments.